So I'm really glad to be here. Let me just say, because I'm a lawyer, at least in the state of California, I have to say something like, I have to have a disclaimer. I'm going to talk about law, but it's not legal advice, and I'm a lawyer, but not your lawyer. That's what that comes down to say. The Change Lives Solutions, our tagline is healthy communities for all through better laws and policy. So we really, the core of what we do are model laws, model policies, how-to kits. I'll talk about that more at the end. But I'm going to lead with, if you want sustainable equity strategies, you have got to be using public health law resources to achieve that. Otherwise, you're just going to be having flash in the pans. Change, social change, laboratories of democracy. This is a concept out of a Supreme Court case from the 1920s where we really look to local government to experiment, see what works, bubble that up. Some will work, some will fail. We really learn what works, and then we get the state and federal governments involved. And then practical solutions for the common good. I'm going to give a quick overview of the problems, and I bet a lot of you know what I'm going to talk about, but I'm going to put a little zinger in there to really focus on why we need a particular lens on equity when we do our work. So this is the San Francisco Bay Area. We see these slides all over where we show the discrepancies in longevity based on where you live. I'm not going to dwell on this at all, except you can see that there's a big difference between 71 years in low-income communities of color and 87 years in higher incomes, predominantly white communities. We see this all over the country. It's really driving our place-based approach. And we know, and it's core to our training, from way back when in the early 1980s at the UC Berkeley School of Public Health right up to present time, that place, race, wealth, health are all linked with each other, that we have to have a social justice approach to our work if we're going to be effective at all. We have unhealthy norms, and this is the major problem that we have. We want bikeable, walkable communities. We have sidewalks. If we have sidewalks, they're often decrepit, and we have infrastructure that is failing communities. There are no sidewalks in many communities. Let me just have to give a shout out to Atlanta, where CDC is, and I take my heart is in my throat every time on that Buford Highway where you see kids waiting for schools crossing 4 to 6 lanes of cars going in every direction, standing in the median, you know, trying to get to the other side. It's an absolute disgrace. And our cars are, we have over proliferation of cars, I almost guarantee you that this freeway is going through a low income community of color. Why can I guarantee that? It's because this is probably built in the 1950s when the highway transportation system was put in. It's a part of the Department of Defense. And they bought up the cheapest land because they had to, you know, buy up all this land to put freeways through. And so that was in low-income communities of color, almost by definition, a type of structural institutional racism that lives to this day and all the health effects that go along with it. We have blighted neighborhoods, locked up, closed. This could be a community garden. It's just collecting trash. We have public facilities that are locked up. This is an abandoned school property with courts right there for play that can't be used, but there's plenty of schools that are locked up, particularly in low-income communities of color where there's less parklands and less safe parklands locked up and not used, not available to the community. We have huge problems with access to healthy foods. If there's food, it's not healthy in too many communities. And we have just the worst kind of food available and no expectation that people will cook or use healthy food products. And if they're there, they're moldy and unaffordable. I would say this is another social determinant of health, the overabundance of certain kinds of food. This is due to land use decisions that put an overproliferation of unhealthy foods, largely in low-income communities. This is where people can get jobs. This is what people are acculturated to eat as a primary food source. And we wonder when we see the advertisement on TV and every type of food we see is another type of fast food, why we have an obesity epidemic. And the overproliferation of soda in our lives. And none of these things I have to dwell on in this crowd, I know. But we'd also look at the housing stock and the molds, the lack of housing, in communities and the housing that's there and the links to lead poisoning, asthma, and tremendous long-term chronic diseases for poor children. And the displacement of housing. One of the big issues that we're working on now at Change Lab Solutions, we're kind of known for our obesity-related work and tobacco work, and obesity has been access to healthy foods and bikeable, walkable communities. We all say, yay, of course we need that. It's leading, those are the seeds of gentrification and displacement of low-income communities being pushed out. Well, finally, there's, you know, some decent food here and a bike lane that can get me right downtown, and rents go up and people are pushed out. And so we've got the whole new push on linking affordable housing, preserving, protecting, enhancing affordable housing, and really helping health departments as you do your chronic disease work to think about the upstream, the long-term consequences of that work and plan for it at the outset. So I want to look at some of the solutions to this. And, you know, another story about tobacco control. In fact, I'm going to tell another story about tobacco control in California, and this is where I'm going to put a twist. So we all know, guess what? If you hadn't heard, tobacco use causes disease. And this was, you know, a common sight many years ago. It's less and less common now. And why is that? And if you've seen this slide before, forgive me, but I'm just going to drive it home. Public policy. The reason why we don't see smoking in public anymore is public policy. So what happened in World War II? What happened in World War II? Why do we see that big spike? Yeah.
Soldiers were given cigarettes with all.
Thank you. Soldiers were given cigarettes. That was a public policy. This, again, the Department of Defense gave. Why were they intending to kill more GIs from tobacco-related diseases than died in the war? Was that an intent to harm the GIs? Absolutely not. Quite the opposite. You know, the nicotine calms you down. It was kind of a treat, but it was a public policy. And those soldiers came back addicted. Their wives and girlfriends became addicted. My father was 15 when the war was over. My father died of tobacco-related diseases 7 years ago. So all the younger kids, he was 15, and their heroes were addicted. Everybody smoked. And it wasn't until we had the public policy movement, really I've got to give shout-out to Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights, Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, these big funders and activists in tobacco control that showed us the way that when you get smoke-free workplaces, when you have raise your tobacco taxes, that you can start driving down the incidence of tobacco-related diseases. And in California, we led the way. I worked for Contra Costa Health Department, straight out of public health school, and we had 18 cities. We were the first multi-jurisdictional city in the world, probably, for smoke-free workplace ordinances. And it was awful. You could smoke in your private office, and if you didn't have one, you couldn't smoke. So there was all this ridiculous. You know, you go into a restaurant smoking or non-smoking as if that mattered. You know, the smoking was at the back of the airplane as if that mattered. One of the mayors in our town, in a small town in our county, husband was an airline pilot, a non-smoker, and he died of lung cancer. Carolyn Bovet. And she took it upon herself to make sure that every city in our county passed this ordinance. And the health department was her partner in this. Cancer, Heart, and Lung, for the first time ever, worked on public policy and that dirty P word. And for the first time ever, worked with each other. We did. Who's ever heard of Contra Costa County, except for people in California? The small kind of backwater place. Larry Cohen from the Prevention Institute was my boss. We did it. And then that campaign went. Finally, San Francisco, they hate being outdone by their East Bay neighbors. They did it better than any of us did. Then Los Angeles always looks to San Francisco. If San Francisco passes the test, Los Angeles, 87 cities in Los Angeles. We started a snowball, and we had, in 20 years, the first 20 years of the California Tobacco Control Program, 25 fewer tobacco-related deaths, close to 7 billion less packs of cigarettes sold, and $134 billion in health care savings alone. You know, this is a great story by any account, but this is where I'm going to give you the zinger. That's hard to see. That's a map of California. We have what you think is comprehensive tobacco control in California, but if you go and dig into the data, really start driving data, where are the exemptions? Oh, service workers in hotels, cleaning the rooms, working in the bars and hotels, exempt. Primarily low-income women of color. Truck drivers, warehouse workers, assembly line workers, not guaranteed coverage. You could pass it at the local level, but the state law that has all this great, you know, the model for the world on how to do tobacco control has exemptions. Who do those exemptions hurt most? Home health care workers, long-term care facilities, outdoor workers, construction workers, people working in the outdoors. In every instance, predominantly lower income, if not very low income, people of color. If we don't take a specific equity lens to our public policies, we will fail in reaching the populations most at risk and bearing the greatest burden of disease. So we all know that public policy is important, but if we don't put a lens on top of that policy and really examine what we're doing, we could be failing the communities we are most concerned about working with and protecting their health. So we have developed specific resources zeroing in. It's called Left Behind in the Smoke. It's targeted at the California Tobacco Control Program and all of our government agency partners in this, and taking a look at these exemptions and closing these loopholes, which thankfully in California we have the ability to do so at the local level. Not every state can do that. And we're on a campaign to close these loopholes and protect all adults from secondhand smoke. I give that just as one example of the reason for our data to take a special look, a deeper look at equity. So when we talk about targeted universalism, we want all people to be protected from secondhand smoke, all children to have safe places to play. Yeah, that's right. And in particular, let's target those communities and those neighborhoods that don't have that same ability to live full and productive lives. So first strategy, collect the data and collect it with a lens to equity. Second strategy is engage the community. And there are a million different ways to engage the community. This in engaging children, this I love this picture. On the one side is the pollution, and then we have solar power and clean air on the other side. This picture made it into a general plan of the city in California, their land use planning agency, really involving the kids in this work. Getting the high school students involved. I was just talking, I did a presentation in the previous session, and somebody from New York City Health Department working with youth on tobacco control issues. I'll tell you, elected officials have a really hard time when youth speak truth to power about their lives. There's really nothing more powerful than in passing public policy and really getting them, what do they want their community to look like? Who do they want to be in that community, and what's it going to be like? I want to give a story from Louisville, Kentucky, that worked on walking policies. And this is years ago, they did walk audits all over the city and targeted universalism. All people deserve walkable neighborhoods. And they targeted in the neighborhoods that had particular concerns with blight and no sidewalks or unmaintained sidewalks and engaged the community in that effort, built the political will for it. There was a brouhaha. Excuse me, I get it. Here, yeah. Bring it with me.
California water.
This is Illinois water. There was a brouhaha. The mayor got pushed out. Corruption charges brought against whomever. Heads rolled. New people come in. They have to cut the budgets because so much money was lost. The thing that did not get cut, they tried to cut, did not get cut, was the Walkable Communities Program. There was so much citizen involvement and commitment to that program, they didn't dare touch it. So the idea of engaging the community is for the sustainability, too. That's where you're going to build ownership for the communities, not just at the government level. We have to change the social norms through policy, and I'm just going to give a bunch of examples of how we do this. Building complete streets. The idea is that the streets are for all people. You can see the cyclists there. You've got the crosswalks. You see in the far depth of the picture, the wheelchair going across the crosswalks. It could be a baby stroller. You see cars. You see mass transit. Everybody's got a place. This is a public policy that leads to sustainability. Also, you'll see retail below, housing above. You've got dense communities where you get you do use economic development because you've got enough of a population base right there that can walk around and support the retail environment. Highly winnable strategy for all sorts of chronic disease. We developed this with the lens of obesity because that's what our funding is from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. But this could be climate change, too. This is aging in place. This is community mental health. People engage in the socialization, getting out of their homes. All sorts of policies wrap up into one overall strategy. Parks and open spaces, making sure they're accessible, making sure they're safe. New affordable housing that's protected over the long haul and particularly close to transit-oriented development. This takes advanced planning. As soon as a TOD, transit-oriented development, goes in, land use prices go up and you can't put affordable housing there anymore. Local government has got to get on top of this issue, buy the land, own the land in advance, and then announce the TODs. Attract new food stores. This is obviously needed, and zone for farmers markets. I want to give an example from Fresno. Fresno, California is one of the poorest cities in the country. Very low income. It's in our agricultural area of the state. Low income people there tend to be farm workers. In the lowest income neighborhood in Fresno, you could not do two things. You could not sell produce, and you could not have a farmer's market. You couldn't have a farmer's market anywhere in Fresno. Why is that? And it was because their general plan that had been written about 40 years ago and never updated said in this community, in this neighborhood, you could sell tobacco, alcohol, you could have a deli, you could sell confectionaries, but you could not sell produce. Everybody who wrote that general plan was long gone. Nobody knew why it was there, but there were no produce sales in this community, predominantly farm workers who need access to healthy food. I mean, the irony on top of irony. And, you know, as soon as that became, the planning agency became aware of it, like, well, changing that, and of course they did change it. You couldn't have a farmer's market in Fresno because there was no definition in the general plan about what a farmer's market is, and if it wasn't defined, it couldn't happen. So again, this is the health department, and we were supporting the health department with California endowment funds, helped bring the health light to the public policy. And they changed it. They were glad to change it, and they're using the farmers market as the anchor for the downtown redevelopment and revitalization program. The farmers market comes in, people come in, other vendors come in. So the strategy that we talked about early on is health in all policies. When you look at, this is county health rankings data, you've probably seen it, health behaviors and environment are 70, sometimes you see 80% of what's causing the disease. Look at how much money is put into prevention, 4%. If health departments think they're going to use their prevention dollars to solve 80%, 70% of disease, they're wrong, they will fail. It will not happen. They're completely outgassed. So we have to use the tools of other sectors of civil society who have the know-how, the legal authority, and the money to act. Health departments don't know too much about transportation, housing, schools, economic development. They have to work cross-sector if they're going to be able to address that 70 to 80% of chronic disease and the causes of ill health in this nation. This will be a bold plug for Change Lab Solutions, but I will tell you we have millions of dollars invested in our work that are on our website, free for download by anybody who wants them. Lots and lots of toolkits, how-to guides, model policies and ordinances that will bring you, if you're in California, it'll bring you 90 for tobacco control, 90 to 100% of where you need to go. If you're in another state, 80%, and you've got to tie it into your state law. But they're models all based on best available science, best available practices, fact sheets, easy to read, and moving more and more into infographics and user-led learning. So all of these infographics, you can drill down into more specific detail and connect to the model policies if you want to learn more and do more. And with that, I will say thank you and pass the baton.
Who's if there's one question where we just, I want to make sure we have time for all our panelists, but one quick question, and then otherwise we'll go do this all at the end. You were first, so.
Well, just a quick note to Harris's story and present, because although zoning is allowed, in order to start a farmer's market, there's a very high condition use permit, right? So it is still not comprehensive in terms of the equity and health and all policy. But Harris, what really struck me when you were talking, and something I hadn't thought about before, is the gentrification issue when we're bringing in these amenities. And it seems to me like a protective factor for disadvantaged communities is ownership. It's ownership of their land or ownership of their homes. And so I think, what is it that we can do to help?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I need to say it better, but Central Valley, California, was our key community organizers. Even home ownership helps our communities because the property taxes will go up and people will feel like they have to sell their homes because they can't afford the taxes anymore. So, yes, it's helpful, but it's not sufficient. Necessary, but not sufficient. So there's lots of strategies, and go on our website, look up Healthy Housing. We have one resource called Preserving, Protecting, Enhancing Affordable Housing, and there's dozens and dozens of strategies in there, including having differential property tax rates for low-income communities so they can hold on to the previous tax rate while still they can stay in their homes. That would be one example. Proactive rental inspection programs to improve the housing stock of rental units without putting tenants at risk for retaliation, and there's all sorts of strategies in there, and we've just got some funding to do some more work on healthy housing, so more to come on that. It's a pressing issue, particularly in Central Cities all over the nation.
Great. Thank you.
Beth, we'll come back.
But let me. We'll come back. I'm just sensitive time. That's a great question. I want to say there's a place mark in the example coming up, Beth. That's not really a question. It's some ideas here, the back and forth. I think a lot of the discussion on health and all policies, how to engage sectors, is a new burgeoning area. And so there are a lot of ideas, there are toolkits, there's beginnings, but this is about some experimenting, taking a look at different partnerships and the alliances, that it can't just be all public health. It has got to be a community owned. And that's, I think, a big part of Maris's message.
Thank you.